Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the sentencing this coming Tuesday of Trump's former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and Special Counsel Robert Mueller's rejection of Flynn's lame excuse that he was tricked into lying to the FBI. Douglas Wise, who served as Deputy Director of the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, from 2014 to 2016, joins us to discuss General Flynn's controversial tenure as head of the DIA, which ended in 2014 when President Obama fired him. Then at a meeting on November the 10th, 2016, at the White House shortly after Trump won the election, Obama personally urged Trump not to hire Flynn. We will assess whether Flynn, like Manafort, who also lied to the FBI investigators, is angling for a pardon from Trump, and how so much of Flynn's shady business dealings and conspiratorial beliefs went undetected or ignored by Trump, the most egregious of these being Flynn's acceptance of $530,000 from Turkey's Erdogan, apparently on the promise of kidnapping and rendering Fethullah Gulen from exile in Pennsylvania to face charges in Turkey that the cleric engineered the failed military coup against Erdogan. And apart from leading the chant of lock her up at the Republican convention, Flynn pushed the conspiracy theory that Hillary Clinton was running an underground pedophile prostitution racket out of a pizza parlor in Georgetown, which inspired a rescue attempt by an impressionable disciple armed with an assault rifle who believed the nonsense Flynn and his son were promoting. Then we will speak with former ambassador to Ukraine, Stephen Pfeiffer, the William Perry Fellow at Stanford University Center for International Security and Cooperation, about alarm expressed by the Ukrainian government about a Russian military buildup on Ukraine's western border. We'll look into why it is unlikely Russia will reignite the war in the Donbas, since Putin is already successfully squeezing Ukraine via his unannounced blockade of Ukrainian shipping in and out of the Sea of Azov under a new bridge over the Kerch Straits, which Russia just built, connecting their mainland to Crimea. We will also discuss the significance of Ukraine's split from the Russian Orthodox Church. And then finally, following the recent verdict by a jury in Charlottesville, Virginia, that 21-year-old avowed neo-Nazi Alex Fields Jr. should be sentenced to 419 years in jail and pay a $480,000 fine for plowing his car into a crowd and killing Heather Heyer, we'll speak with Kathleen Ballou, a professor of history at the University of Chicago who researches the 20th century history of white power militancy through previously classified FBI documents. The author of the new book, Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America, she joins us to trace the history of a movement which has emerged from the shadows with the arrival of Trump, who appears reluctant to criticize neo-Nazis and white supremacists. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Douglas Wise, who served as Deputy Director of the Defense Intelligence Agency from 2014 to 2016, following 20 years of active duty in the Army, where he served as an infantry and special operations officer. And then he spent 3 decades at the CIA as a member of their senior intelligence service. He's currently a contributing writer at the Cipher Brief. Welcome to Background Briefing, Douglas Wise.
Well, Ian, thank you for the warm welcome, and I'm pleased to be able to help clarify some issues, and I'm certainly honored to be considered among your panel of experts.
Well, thank you, Douglas. And so let's begin with General Flynn undergo some kind of change? My understanding, tell me about his tenure as the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. It obviously ended with Obama firing him. So why did Obama fire him?
Well, first thing is the president did not fire him. It was senior officials in the Pentagon for whom he worked who deny them his third year, which is concomitant to being fired. When Flynn came in, I wasn't there. I was there in the summer of 14 and to the end of his tenure. But I certainly inherited all of the good and all of the bad that devolved from his time as the director. I think he came in and was challenged by wanting to be the commanding general of Defense Intelligence Agency versus the director. He seemed to create some controversial policies. He seemed to distance himself from his senior civilian leadership, surrounded himself by an ideological Praetorian guard. And then what he essentially did was fail to do the things that the senior Pentagon officials had asked him to do. And then he did things that the Pentagon officials told him not to do. The whole issue that he has posited, and others who are in support of him, that somehow he was fired because he was an ideological opposition to President Obama is a canard and just a rationalization that's all part of the latter years of Flynn's saga. I mean, there's no way that the President of the United States would even have known Mike Flynn's name. First thing is the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and it's a great agency, by the way, remarkable with the workforce. That's not a cabinet official position, unlike the Central Intelligence Agency director. So CIA director goes down, attends PCs, the deputy director attends DCs. You know, the director of DIA, nor did I, as the deputy director of DIA, did we participate at that level. Those were the roles performed by senior Pentagon officials. So the likelihood that President Obama would even know about Mike Flynn, the fact that there were no venues for Flynn to speak of his opposition to the president's policies on Iran and on the war against terror, I mean, it's just not something that's going to happen. I mean, the whole thing was a rationalization and an attempt to put some nobility on Flynn's insubordination to his senior Defense Department officials.
And, of course, there's an extra layer now with the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, would indicate that he would be further down the pecking order in terms of ever getting to do a White House briefing. So what then happened on November the 10th, shortly after the election, when President Trump visited the White House and apparently President Obama urged him not to hire Michael Flynn as his national security director?
Oh, well, Ian, let me speculate, and let me say it up front. I was not privy to any classified information related to FISA collection against the Russian diplomatic presence in the United States. I would presume that the Russian ambassador, Ambassador Kisiak, would have been on coverage. I think it'd be something very prudent to do. Our ambassador in Moscow certainly was under coverage, and as our next speaker, the ambassador to former ambassador to Ukraine, he was certainly under coverage. And so anybody engaging the Russian ambassador would be caught under incidental collection. And certainly Flynn and talking to us on the phone or meeting with the Russian ambassador would have been caught in this incidental collection that would be very necessary for U.S. national security. So I presume that when a very senior former, soon to be another former senior government official, Mike Flynn, was caught talking to the Russian ambassador on subjects that were quite alarming, I would presume that would be brought to the attention of President Obama through the DNI and through the director of the FBI. And I would imagine, and this is pure speculation on my part, but I think it's an educated speculation, that Obama, knowing that, believing somehow that Trump would find this as offensive and as dangerous and reckless as certainly the Obama administration did, brought that to the attention of the president, suggested, and I have no idea what details were provided in addition, but highly recommended that the president not hire Mike Flynn because of Mike Flynn's behavior as determined by incidental collection.
And again, I'm speaking with Douglas Wise, who served as Deputy Director of the Defence Intelligence Agency from 2014 to 2016, following 20 years of active duty in the Army, where he served as an infantry and special operations officer. And then he spent 3 decades at the CIA as a member of their senior intelligence service and is currently a contributing writer at the Cypher Brief. So given that Flynn is about to be sentenced on Tuesday, and just on Friday, the special counsel Robert Mueller pushed back on Flynn's sentencing filings to the judge, where he basically came up with a lame excuse that somehow the FBI had tricked him into lying to them. That is obviously pretty laughable, isn't it, from a guy with that kind of background?
Well, absolutely, Ian. I mean, let's face it, somebody who is a career military intelligence official, was a 3-star general, had an extraordinary career in military intelligence, and then ultimately ended up at the top position of military intelligence as director of DIA. It's absurd on its face value that somehow Mike Flynn would not be fully aware that lying to federal investigators during the conduct of an official investigation, that's just absurd. And again, it's part of what I see as a pattern of rationalization. First rationalization being Obama fired me. The second rationalization that we've just had that you indicated was the agents tripped, and this was a perjury trap. And so, you know, it just seems to me to be part of a pattern of rationalization. And there's no way Mike Flynn could plead ignorance of this, given the nature of his career, his seniority, and his experience. No way.
Well, he wrote this book, Flynn, with Michael Ledeen, and that was just prior to Trump appointing him as National Security Advisor against the advice of President Obama. During the that George W. Bush tenure, there was the yellow cake from Niger. Do you remember that whole thing? The ambassador wrote a letter and his CIA wife was outed by Dick Cheney and all that stuff. Well, at that time, I did an interview with Vince Canestrera, who's a former senior CIA official, and I mentioned to him that, you know, that isn't there a chance that those the documents which are used as the justification for the Iraq war in many ways, the idea that Saddam was buying a yellow cake from Niger. I said, you know, my understanding is those documents were forged. And I said, you know, forged probably in Italy or somewhere. And he said, no, they were done over here. And I said, by whom? And he said, I'm not at liberty to say. And I said, well, if I mentioned the name Michael Ledeen, what would you say? And he said, I'd say you were very close. And then immediately I got a threat from Michael Ledeen that he would sue me unless I made an apology. So Michael Ledeen has a pretty shady background. What happened to Flynn? Why did he get involved with these fringe conspiracy type people?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I suppose you'd probably have to discuss that with a psychiatrist. I mean, how do you go from the consummate military intelligence professional to being in concert with some of these extraordinarily, you know, fringe people and fringe issues, and then appearing on the national stage at the Republican convention screaming "lock her up"? It's a, quite frankly, it's a mystery to me. I wish I could explain it. If I take Flynn's own words, that somehow in his first connect with the president-elect, or soon to be president-elect, but at that time the Republican candidate, that Flynn himself described this as a denouement for him ideologically and emotionally, and that he finally found somebody who's, you know, an ideological partner for his beliefs. And that was the turning point, and he's never been the same since. And I'm obviously paraphrasing. I've not read a single thing that was in Flynn's book. But the fact of the matter is that I think the evidence is clear that at the point in time that he connected with national politics, that was a transformational moment for General Flynn out of being a military intelligence professional and into the political domain. And I also have to believe that there probably is an element of anger that Mike Flynn held as a result of his being relieved of command of the DIA. And I have to believe that he was motivated to a degree by that anger in trying to strike back and obviously act upon his beliefs that the Obama administration was taking a flawed and dangerous policy approach. And so I think if you turn the crank on all that, I think you're going to find somebody who's become of a form and fashion that is quite inexplicable. I mean, it's very hard for all of us that were associated with Mike Flynn, and I was for a number of years, to explain how you can go from the consummate three-star general military intelligence professional to somebody, as you said, that could believe that Hillary Clinton was running a child pedophile ring out of a pizza parlor next to the White House. I mean, it's just absolutely absurd, and something had to go wrong in the way Mike Flynn was viewing the world, viewing politics, viewing the state of the nation. And it was an unhealthy perspective, and you can see the results. I mean, if you get fired by this administration for lying, I mean, this is kind of the equivalent of the mafia firing a hitman for killing too many people. I mean, it's just hard to understand.
Well,
why Mike Flynn would be doing that. I mean, I just don't understand that.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, there's also the other aspect. Of course, he's deep in the Russian story. And we mentioned the coverage, how he came up as incidental collection because they were watching Kislyak, the Russian ambassador. And there was, of course, a famous meeting that took place on December the 10th of 2016 where Flynn and Jared Kushner met with Ambassador Kislyak and the head of the VNDB bank, known as Putin's slush fund, at which Jared Kushner apparently asked for $500 million from the Russians to bail out 666 Fifth Avenue. That was pretty egregious and unprecedented. But there are other incidents. Earlier, of course, General Flynn at Cambridge University seems to have gotten into a honey trap with a young Russian temptress, Svetlana Lukova, who wrote love letters to him. He was also at the 10th anniversary of RT, the Russian propaganda outfit, sitting at the same table with Jill Stein of the Green Party, the father of Julian Assange, and, of course, Vladimir Putin at the head of the table. So what happened there? I mean, when he was in the DIA in June of 2013, Flynn became the first U.S. officer to be allowed inside Russia's military intelligence headquarters, the GRU, in Moscow. What happened with the Russians? Why did he suddenly become soft on the Russians?
Well, I could speculate. And speculation is obviously dangerous, and I have no real data to back this up. First thing is, when the Russians, and I'm not a Russia expert, but my Russia expert colleagues, have spoken, and it's very obvious. The Russians are consummate intelligence operators, and the Russians aren't unsophisticated at all when it comes to this kind of thing. So the Russians began a strategic program that was well-planned and well-executed, and arguably some fortuitous developments that even they couldn't have predicted began to unfold. But the one thing the Russians are is they're great at being flexible and agile when intelligence opportunities present itself. So from the Russian approach, this was an attempt, and again, I'm not saying that the Russians caused an effect on the election outcome, but the Russians certainly recognized that they had an opportunity here from a long time ago, from nascent business relationships, an opportunity to gain access to the national policymakers of the incoming administration. So the Russians played this game exceptionally well. Going back to your question of Mike Flynn, I mean, you may remember Mike Flynn came out of a community of operators where victory goes to the bold. And somehow Flynn transmuted, you know, boldness into recklessness, which I think was fueled by arrogance and a firm belief that he was now too politically connected to fail and be held accountable. It's the only way I can explain that. I've been asked many times, you know, was it an accident that Flynn, as you said, sat at the dinner table with Vladimir Putin? Hardly. No one sits at a dinner table with the President of the United States by accident. Nobody will sit at the table with the President of the Russian Federation by accident. Well planned, well executed by the Russians. And why General Flynn ultimately took money from the Russians, why he took money from the Turks, and perhaps a special prosecutor might know of other sources of foreign income, which was clearly a violation of the constitutional obligations on Mike Flynn and statutory obligations on Mike Flynn. All of those obligations made clearly known to a departing official of his seniority by the Office of Government Ethics, represented by the DOD General Counsel, when they deliver you your Office of Government Ethics letter. So all the things that Mike Flynn did, and again, a mystery as to how you go from a compliant, rules-enforcing senior government official to somebody who so blatantly violated the nation's trust, not just a minor trust with a small t. This was a capital T. He not only violated the nation's trust, but in doing so, he created great risk to the United States, quite frankly. And it makes no sense to me why he would do that, except that he was reckless and he was too well politically connected to fail. And he had a firm belief at that.
Well, Douglas Wise, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Okay, Ian, thanks, and I'm honored to be with your guest.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Douglas Wise, who served as Deputy Director of the Defense Intelligence Agency from 2014 to 2016, following 20 years of active duty in the Army, where he served as an infantry and special operations officer. And he spent 3 decades at the CIA as a member of their senior intelligence service. And he's currently a contributing writer at Cipher Brief. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether the Ukrainians are exaggerating the Russian military buildup on their border.
I'm more important in the USA than a spy for the FBI. I'm trained to meet the criminal elite, and I seek out wherever evil resides. I spy. I'm at home in the streets of Rome.
Rejuvenation, the second wind. When will it begin? Repatriation, what is my sin? When will my ship come in?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Pfeiffer, who is a William Perry Fellow at Stanford's University Center for International Security and Cooperation, a former ambassador to Ukraine. His career as a foreign service officer centered on Europe, the former Soviet Union, and arms control. And in addition to Kiev, he had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer.
Thank you for having me today.
And what do you make of the Ukrainian government's alarm that they've issued about Russian military buildup on their eastern border, the notion being that this Cold War between Russia and Ukraine in Ukraine's east could suddenly become a hot war. I'd take it that U.S. intelligence doesn't entirely agree with the nature of the buildup.
Right. No, I think it certainly bears watching, but I tend to think that the prospects of a major Russian military action against eastern Ukraine at this point in time are rather low.
And why would that be?
Several reasons. First of all, it's winter. That's not a good time for an offensive. For example, the trees in eastern Ukraine are all bare now, so that denies cover to soldiers. Second, a major Russian military offensive is going to require use of regular units of the Russian army. That's going to mean Russian casualties, regular Russian soldiers dying, because the Ukrainian military is much better now than it was back in 2014, and the Kremlin does not like that prospect. Third, you have, if there's a major Russian offensive, a real chance of more severe Western economic sanctions targeted at Russia. Fourth, if the Russians take more territory, they're going to begin to run the risk that they reach the point that they take in territory where there's active hostility, that they may have to then deal with a guerrilla campaign. And I guess the last question is, you know, if you look at the last 4 years, Russia has shown no indication that it actually wants to annex eastern Ukraine or parts of eastern Ukraine like Donbas. It's very different from Crimea, which they wanted. They look at eastern Ukraine as a way to put pressure on the government in Kyiv. And a bigger offensive may not give them that much more opportunity when they're already succeeding on salami tactics. 3 weeks ago, the Russians attacked and seized three small Ukrainian naval vessels, and they're now able to assert unilateral control over the Sea of Azov and increase the economic pressure on Ukraine by denying access to Ukrainian ports on the Sea of Azov. So I think the Russians have a strategy that's working. A major military offensive would pose all sorts of risks that they probably don't want to face at this time.
Well, my understanding is that the Ukrainian port of Mariupol on the Sea of Azov, which has to be accessed through the Kerch Straits, where Putin and his friend Rotenberg have built this very expensive land bridge joining Russia to Crimea. So any trade with Ukraine into its eastern port of Mariupol has to go through the Straits of Kerch, and that's where there have been incidents with Russian patrol boats shooting up Ukrainian patrol boats. My understanding is that the shipping into Mariupol has dropped dramatically, so it looks as if Russia's got some kind of economic blockade going there. How do you see it?
No, I think that's correct. I mean, Mariupol on the Sea of Azov is Ukraine's third largest port. It exports grain, iron, steel products from eastern Ukraine. There are other ports like Berdyansk. And when the Russians built the bridge over the Kerch Strait, first of all, the bridge was built without any consultations with Ukraine. And the height of the bridge means that a number of ships that used to call on the port of Mariupol can no longer enter the Sea of Azov. But other than that, for smaller ships that can pass under the bridge, you've had reports over the last 6 or 8 months of Russians stopping the ships, demanding inspections without real cause, but basically designed to slow down the normal traffic to the point where I think some shippers are saying it's not worth going to a Ukrainian port on the Sea of Azov because doing so has the risk that the ship may be sitting somewhere 4 or 5 or 6 days waiting for an inspection, which has no real purpose other than harassment of the ship and harassment of Ukraine. And then you had, of course, this incident 3 weeks ago where three Ukrainian naval vessels, a tugboat and two small gunboats, were trying to pass through the Kerch Strait. And they had the right to do that both under international maritime law. There's this term called innocent passage, but also specifically under an agreement that Ukraine and Russia concluded in 2003 that allowed ships of both countries, both commercial vessels but also state-owned military vessels, to pass through the Kerch Strait. You know, the Russians attacked those ships, and I think what you're seeing now is the Russians trying to assert unilateral control over the Sea of Azov, And since that incident 3 weeks ago, there have been reports that Ukrainian ships are being forced to wait days to pass through the strait to go to the Sea of Azov. Unfortunately, the West has expressed lots of concern, but no real reaction. And I worry that the Russians are now going to conclude that this tactic has succeeded, and now they're in a position by slowing passage or blocking passage through the Kerch Strait and the Sea of Azov to really impose some severe economic costs on Ukrainian ports such as Mariupol.
And again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Stephen Pieper, who is a William Perry Fellow at Stanford University's Center for International Security and Cooperation, a former ambassador to Ukraine. His career as a foreign service officer centered on Europe, the former Soviet Union, and arms control. And in addition to Kiev, he had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. So it would seem then that this military buildup that the Ukrainians are warning about, saying that the Russians are building up military assets on their border, poised to reignite the war in the Donbass. And, of course, the war in the Donbass is right up to this port of Mariupol that we're talking about. It's barely in the control of the Ukrainians. So if what you just told us, Ambassador Pieper, is the situation where Russia is successfully conducting an economic blockade of Ukraine's exports, particularly its important exports of wheat, then they don't need a military buildup, do they? They don't need, as you pointed out, at a certain point, if Russia goes too far into a war with Ukraine, they're going to be stuck with guerrilla warfare. And I think that's ultimately why I don't see Russia as a great threat. They can certainly cause a lot of mischief, but I can't believe that Putin would be reckless enough to really push the envelope, because the further he moves to the west into the former Soviet Union and the Baltic states and in Ukraine, the more likelihood that the Russian army would be bogged down in guerrilla warfare.
No, I think that's exactly right. And again, it's the question to my mind is, the Russians control enough of Donbass now and with their simmering conflict to put pressure on the government in Kyiv. I don't see a specific additional objective. 3 years ago, in early 2015, there was concern that the Russian military and their proxies might try to take Mariupol itself. But what's happened in those 3 years is the Ukrainians have done a lot to fortify that city. And really, a nightmare for a modern army is actually going in and trying to capture a city that's been fortified. It gets down to a very, very difficult block-to-block type operation. And it's the kind of thing likely to generate the sorts of casualties that the Kremlin over the last 4 years has taken great efforts to hide from the Russian people. So at this point in time, it certainly bears watching, and the Russians may be putting some additional forces in proximity to the border simply to alarm Ukraine. But I think the prospects of a major Russian offensive at this point in time are not all that large. They are succeeding with their salami tactics, with the actions to move to assert control over the Kerch Strait and the Sea of Azov, and it seems to me that a major offensive just poses risks that the Kremlin at this point in time probably does not want to take.
So what then is going on with this split between the Ukrainian Orthodox Church and the Russian Orthodox Church? It's really angered Putin. Why so?
Right. Well, if you go back to when I was in Ukraine in the 1990s, at that point in time, there were really three Orthodox churches. One was the Ukrainian Orthodox Church that was loyal to the Moscow Patriarchate. There was then the Ukrainian Orthodox Church that was loyal to the Kiev Patriarchate. And then there was a third, smaller Ukrainian Orthodox Church. The church that was loyal to Moscow was actually, in the 1990s, the largest Ukrainian Orthodox Church, both in terms of numbers of parishes and also in terms of a number of adherents. But that's changed over the last 25 years, and particularly over the last 4 years. In fact, some people now say that the Ukrainian Orthodox Church Kiev Patriarchate has more adherents than the Moscow Patriarchate, because Ukrainians have sort of turned against Russia as a result of the Russian aggression, the seizure of Crimea in 2014, and the actions by Russia and Russian proxy forces in Donbass. And so what's happened yesterday is that the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, Kiev Patriarchate, And the smaller, the third church, have now unified. They've elected the new patriarch. And on January 6th, they will be given by Patriarch Bartholomew in Constantinople, Thomas, which will establish that church as Ukraine's Orthodox Church, reporting directly to Constantinople, not via Moscow. The Russians do not like this. It's been very clear that the Kremlin does not like this. The Russian Orthodox Church does not like this. And the reason the Russian government does not like this is they have seen the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, Moscow Patriarchate, or at least that's what it used to be called, as an instrument for Russian influence in Ukraine. A lot of Ukrainians have moved away from that church because they've said, you know, how can we, you know, go to a church which has its loyalties to Moscow, given the war that Russia has inflicted on Ukraine? And even you see stories about priests of the Russian Orthodox Church out blessing Russian soldiers and even Russian weapon systems that are then used to kill Ukrainians. So this has been one of those things that has led Ukrainians to change. And yesterday was a big day in terms of establishment of that church and the election of their new patriarch.
Well, the Ukrainian president, Petro Poroshenko, said, and he quoted the national poet, Taras Shevchenko, he said, "Ukraine will no longer drink Moscow's poison from the Moscow cup. The final acquisition, this is the, today's events is the final acquisition of independence from Russia." And then he went on to talk about the new Ukrainian church, saying, "This is a church without Putin. What kind of a church is this? It is the church without Kirill. What kind of church is this? It is a church without prayers for the Russian government and Russian military." So at the end of the day, you have to ask yourself, what has Putin achieved? I mean, he's grabbed Crimea and it's created massive sanctions against him, and he's whipped up nationalism and maintained his popularity. But are Russians wondering what they've really gained? I mean, the Ukrainians and Russians throughout the Soviet period were brothers. Now they hate each other. That's not a good development.
No, this has been a huge change. When I served in Embassy Kyiv in the late 1990s, I would say, you know, in certain parts of Western Ukraine, there were Ukrainian nationalists who had a lot of antipathy towards Moscow, but they were very small in number. Most Ukrainians either liked Russia, they had relatives or friends in Russia, they saw Russia as a neighborly state, or they were ambivalent. That has changed usually, particularly in the last 4 years. And this is a result of Vladimir Putin's action. Somebody once said, well, Putin gained Crimea when he seized it in 2014, but he lost Ukraine. And you see numbers now showing antipathy towards Russia on a broad swath of the population. You see polls showing Ukrainians want to see their country firmly in the European Union. For the first time since independence, now numbers show a plurality of Ukrainians and sometimes even a majority want to see Ukraine in NATO. And it's going to take decades to overcome the differences, the hatred, the antipathy that Putin's actions have built between two countries, which are going to be neighboring states for the foreseeable future. You know, Ukraine and Russia are going to be side by side. But this is all, I think, an action that Putin miscalculated grossly on.
Well,
and
I think that
will
just
be a problem.
But just in closing, Ambassador Stephen Pyfer, doesn't that go to the notion that too many analysts in the West have attributed such genius to Putin? You know, I think it's a pretty straightforward situation. He's ahead of a criminal syndicate that's looting Russia. He uses totalitarian tactics and control of the press to basically disguise how much looting is going on. And when the population gets more restive, he entertains them with a bread and circuses war, whether it's in Chechnya, which is how he rose to power, Georgia, or Ukraine. And he's not necessarily the great long-term thinker and strategist that a lot of analysts attribute to him.
Yeah, no, I tend to think that Putin's stronger suit is tactics. He's very good at trying to create options when he gets into a certain situation. But I don't believe that he thinks long-term. I mean, had he thought long-term, my guess is Russia probably would have gotten away with it, with very few sanctions, had they taken Crimea and stopped there. Crimea was relatively bloodless. I think the Russian argument, the historical Russian claim for Crimea, could have been persuasive with a lot of Western countries. And it would have been a problem in Russia's relations with the West, but it would not have been a major one. But they overreached. They launched the conflict in eastern Ukraine. And you see this in other aspects. I mean, Putin, over the last, 6 years since he came back to the presidency, even though when he was prime minister before that, he really was the person calling the shots, has made economic decisions that have resulted in the Russian state acquiring more economic power. I think Russian companies, Russian parastatals now run about 65 to 70% of the Russian economy. That reverses a trend that you saw back in the 90s and the early 2000s. But he's also shied away from the kind of economic reforms that I believe Russia needs if it's going to be a successful economy. And he seems to be afraid of those reforms because it means opening some things up, loosening some things up. So as a consequence, he has an economy that's growing at maybe 1.5% per year. That's not going to, in the long run, fulfill the needs of Russia. But it's almost as if Mr. Putin's timeline is just looking at the next several years. I believe he's making decisions that will leave Russia as a much weaker state in, say, the late 2020s or the 2030s, but that doesn't seem to be something that he thinks about. He's not a long-term strategist, in my view. He has too much of a short-term perspective in ways that will be ultimately not beneficial for Russia.
Well, Ambassador Stephen Pieper, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pieper, who's a William Perry Fellow at Stanford University's Center for International Security and Cooperation, a former ambassador to Ukraine. His career as a foreign service officer centered on Europe, the former Soviet Union, and arms control. And in addition to Kiev, he had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into the verdict by a jury in Charlottesville, Virginia, that a 21-year-old avowed neo-Nazi was sentenced to 419 years in jail. And we're talking about the rise of the movement, the white power and neo-Nazi movement coming out of the shadows, emerging with the arrival of Donald Trump. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kathleen Ballou, a professor of history at the University of Chicago, who researches the 20th century history of white power militancy through previously classified FBI documents, newspapers published from Nicaragua to New York, and vivid personal testimonies, letters, and illustrations. She's the author of the new book just out, Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kathleen Ballou.
Thank you for having me.
And Kathleen, last week, a jury in Charlottesville sentenced or recommended the sentencing of the 21-year-old avowed neo-Nazi Alex Fields Jr. They recommended life plus 419 years in prison and a $480,000 fine for killing Heather Heyer and seriously injuring 35 others when he ran down the group of protesters with his car, which we all have seen that. And it actually is the postscript or the epilogue of the new Spike Lee film, Black Klansman, as well. So let's begin that. You know, your research starts with the Vietnam War and the aftermath of the Vietnam War. But what is the lineage between the research that you've done and what happened in Charlottesville?
So I studied the white power movement from the post-Vietnam War period through the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. And over the course of that history, what I'm looking at is the way that a bunch of different factions came together under a common set of ideologies and through a social movement that joins people together in relationships with one another across divisions like Klansmen, neo-Nazis, skinhead, radical tax resistors, and others. And one of the things in that story, which sort of spans the time between the main body of Black Klansmen and the postscript footage from the altercation in Charlottesville, are a number of other opportunities where the court system, the military, and the public have had opportunities to confront organized white power violence in the mode that we saw at Charlottesville and have not done so. So I think the closest historical cognate example is the shooting of leftist demonstrators by Klansmen and neo-Nazis in Greensboro, North Carolina in 1979. It's a very similar event to what happened at Charlottesville in 2017. And in that case, there were no convictions.
There were no convictions in spite of the fact that Klansmen in Greensboro massacred five leftist protesters. And these Klansmen had served in Vietnam. And their excuse, if you will, was that, well, I killed communists in Vietnam. Why shouldn't I be able to kill them at home?
That's exactly right. And I should be very clear, not all of those gunmen were veterans. And I should be perfectly clear about the argument I'm making about the role of veterans in surges in vigilante violence. So throughout American history, we see a correlation with the aftermath of warfare and intense spikes in Klan and affiliated vigilante or revolutionary activity. But it turns out that that's not just among veterans. And indeed, the veterans who become involved in this kind of activism represent a tiny percentage of returning veterans as a whole. But the ones who do join these groups take with them a whole lot of important skill sets, including tactics, training, weapons expertise. So they join these groups and do work to paramilitarize the entire movement, including things like obtaining stolen military weapons, running paramilitary training camps, and planning tactics using this kind of sense of expertise to do so. Now, in Greensboro, what we see is that even those the gunmen who were not Vietnam veterans nevertheless used the story of the Vietnam War and exactly this kind of anti-communist discourse to attempt to justify their violence, and did so successfully to avoid prosecution. They did things including posing in front of the local Vietnam War Veterans Memorial in order to raise money for their defense fund, all the way up through talking about their violence as anti-communist instead of as part of a white power movement that sought sort of a more racist and white supremacist set of goals.
It's pretty extraordinary that they got away with it, isn't it? I mean, of course, the federal hate crimes didn't exist in those days.
Right, and there were a number of sort of systemic reasons that prosecution of this particular incident didn't work out the way that it perhaps should. One had to do with entrenched racial bias within the state legal system in North Carolina, such that many jurors were dismissed through peremptory challenges, which is dismissing people without cause, and it's how the South and other places historically has sat all white juries to acquit crimes of this nature, and it was so unconstitutional that it was found it was thrown out just a few years after the state trial. They were then brought up on federal charges, and I should mention too that this shooting in 1979 was captured on three different news cameras, so there are multiple angles of who's shooting. You can see faces, you can see individual action quite clearly in a lot of it. And even still, when it comes to the federal trial, the jury instructions say that they have to prove that the gunmen conspired to deny the dead their civil rights by killing them, but they specify that it has to be for reasons of race. And because the Klansmen and neo-Nazis were using anti-communism as a sort of alibi for racist violence, And because the connection between anti-communism and overt racism was never made clear, they went free again in this the state trial. There was also a third trial, a civil prosecution, that went on to find only one of the deaths wrongful, and that was of the one victim who was not a card-carrying communist at the time of his death. So this shows just how entrenched these ideas are, not only among people who adhere to this movement, but in a broader American public at that time.
And again, I'm speaking with Kathleen Ballou, who is a professor of history at the University of Chicago, who researches the 20th century history of white power militancy through previously classified FBI documents, newspapers published from Nicaragua to New York, and vivid personal testimonies, letters, and illustrations. She's the author of the new book just out, Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America. And, of course, the Vietnam War was fought by America's underclass, largely, and a lot of them were African Americans. So, one of my oldest friends was America's most decorated war hero, Colonel David Hackworth, and his experiences, and he did a lot of tours in Vietnam, were pretty clear that when you're under fire, the person next to you is all you care about, and you don't care about what the color of their skin. So I think that would support the idea that the Klansmen coming out of the Vietnam War were few in number.
Sure. I think that the historical record also shows us that what you're talking about is very true. And I think that for many people, the experience of serving in combat formed long-lasting relationships, changed how they viewed the world. And many people came back from Vietnam and went on to take part in movements for racial justice and other kinds of projects of that kind. But Vietnam was also the first real exercise of the integrated army. And I think that we talk too little about how deeply racially segregated Vietnam still was. So there's evidence of people hanging Confederate battle flags in their living quarters in Vietnam. There are extensive records of race riots, both in Vietnam and in training facilities in the United States. And there's a record of anti-veteran violence against African-American veterans coming back. So I think that the racial picture we have of Vietnam is perhaps not as simple as the kinds of long relationships that can come out of combat, but also has this other element.
Well, it seems to me, though, that the mythology and the grudge, the sense of betrayal that animated the white power movement that you trace in your book, Kathleen Ballou, a lot of it, I think, came out of the MIA movement, which was largely fraudulent, frankly, you know, because Henry Kissinger and company diverted the satellites over Vietnam and Laos looking for these so-called hidden prison camps where they were allegedly holding all of these Americans. And it got to the point where it was unsustainable because they had to move these overhead assets to look at the Soviet Union. And it was just a fool's errand in terms of intelligence. So the myth of these men left behind, which the Rambo movies seem to have really generated the mythology. And, of course, that the first Rambo movie, I think, in many ways, is a story about that, don't you think?
Sure. I it's interesting to think about it through the lens of film. And, I mean, for listeners who are interested in learning more about the POW/MIA movement from a historical perspective, my colleague Michael Allen at Northwestern has a great book on this. But I think POW/MIA is sort of one part of what I would think of as a constellation of cultural myths about the Vietnam War. And I say that with some caution because I don't want to disregard the place that these stories have had in the way that people think about their own experience and insofar as some of it is verified. But there's a sort of coming together of a common narrative about the Vietnam War and how the nation thinks about it that doesn't happen until a bit after the conclusion of combat. So it's not until the early 1980s. And it consolidates a whole lot of elements that are recognizable to a modern listener, largely through what we know about Vietnam War movies, right? So it has to do with betrayal of the government, the idea that people weren't allowed to win, the idea of wronged veterans, the idea of aimless combat patrols and excessive hardship. Now, that happened for a lot of people, but there's another side of the war that has been, I think, less understood. And I think that the narrative power of the Vietnam War, so the power of that story, is part of what I'm trying to document. And as you say, it's not a story that's exclusively taken up by this very small fringe movement that I'm looking at, but it has a lot of traction in the American mainstream too. And I mean, we can see this everywhere, from the real stories told by our veterans to the kind of filmic portrayals of Vietnam War films and the stylized memoirs that proliferate in the 1980s, to bigger cultural phenomena like paintball courses and wearing camouflage fatigues that sort of characterize how the nation as a whole is interacting with this story in the 80s. So what I'm looking at is a tiny, tiny fraction of that bigger phenomenon. But I think the fringe can be useful in showing how all of this comes together and becomes both operationalized and violent for some people in those years.
Well, of course, the great irony of the Vietnam War was, as long as the U.S. was fighting a third world country trying to break their will, they were losing because they were seen by the most of the population, particularly the rural populations, as foreign invaders, the legacy of the French in many ways. But the minute that the war stopped, these sort of boneheaded communist leaders who were great at fighting but terrible at governing were rattling the tin cup asking for aid. And, you know, the history sort of indicates that as long as we're fighting them, we're going to lose. But the minute we stop fighting them, they were the ones that would lose. I mean, that's the way I see it. There's a great irony. And I wish history had been more active in terms of dispelling these absurd myths about betrayal and all of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the place of stories like this has become an area that historians and other scholars have become very interested in the last few years, thinking about the place of cultural imaginary or social imaginary, which is to say the way that those shared stories shape the conditions of possibility for people. Stories aren't just stories. They impact our real lives, and the history really does teach us something about what's happening in the present. And I was just reading today about these new orders about kind of challenges to immigration status of Vietnamese refugees who came over directly after the conflict in Vietnam and during the war as well. Many of whom were American allies and fought for South Vietnam and came to the United States precisely because they would be targeted for reprisal if they stayed in their home country. I write about a lot of this in the book because these same refugees who were allies in the war became targets of Klan harassment in the early 1980s and were called the Viet Cong. It's almost as if it doesn't matter what someone's actual politics are if they can be slotted into this story in a way that works for this grand narrative. And it's just another example of how history is here to show us how we can learn about what's happened before such that we can better confront the present.
Well, in the case of the South Vietnamese being resettled in fishing towns in Texas and down in Florida, too, mm-hmm. I mean, there was local resentment from the white fishermen because I think the Vietnamese is actually better fishermen. But that, I think, is part of a broader picture, which you also show in your book, Catherine Belew, that the irony that these anti-immigrant sentiments are fueled by the blowback and displacement from the wars America wages abroad, whether they were in Vietnam or Iraq, Afghanistan, the Syrian refugee crisis, you know, et cetera. It goes on today.
Yeah. Scholars like Jesse Hoffman-Garskog have shown that a lot of the displacement, most of the displacement of persons that moves people to the United States in the latter 20th century has to do with American foreign policy. So there is a question of how we as a nation want to think about that entire chain of events and not just the arrival of populations.
But the thread that I see in your book and in the history that we're talking about right up to the present, and this exists on both the left and the right in this country, on the fringes, if you will, is this deep alienation from the government itself. In other words, we're the lowest voting of democracies in the world, which I think is a reflection of alienation. People just don't think there's any point in participating. But the idea that the alienation on the right could get so extreme that somebody like McVeigh could blow up a federal building and kill all those innocent people, including a lot of children, to me is just the ultimate in alienation. And I get from your book, Bring the War Home, the White Power Movement and Paramilitary America, I get the idea that this sense of betrayal that was largely manufactured, to my mind, has really fueled this sense of alienation and led to these militia movements and these people traipsing around the woods in camouflage.
Sure. I mean, and it's a way to think about how that sense of betrayal is one of the places where the fringe can really tell us something about more mainstream mobilizations on the right, because that sense of betrayal is shared by a lot of people beyond this tiny fringe movement that I study. And indeed, I mean, a lot of the rhetoric against the state and about the idea of Vietnam as a war that should have been won is coming from the Reagan administration itself. There's anti-statism coming even from the state in the early 1980s. And those currents, you know, have stayed alive and morphed and changed over the intervening years. And there's been a constant process of forgetting that I document in my book. Everything I talk about in the book was reported at the time. I mean, footage of Klan paramilitary training camps appeared on morning news magazine shows. The Greensboro massacre was the subject of a Saturday Night Live sketch. And all of this was reported on and known at the time. But there's been a process of fragmentation and understanding, subsuming stories, and sort of this trope of thinking about this as lone wolf action that has really occluded the picture of white power as a social movement that has a coherent ideology and a set of political reasons for activity, and has never received a really decisive moment of prosecution that would stop its activity.
Well, but this ambivalence, you know, the ATF and the FBI have to deal with it, because when you have people like Ronald Reagan saying the government itself is the problem, and now you've got Trump being a kind of catalyst for all of these white supremacists and neo-Nazis coming out of the woodwork and feeling empowered, and David Duke at Charlottesville, you know, praising Trump as their leader, in effect, it's not surprising that people like the Bundys start strutting their stuff. And again, the Bundys and that incident at the Wildlife Institute in Oregon, again, these guys got off. I mean, it's extraordinary.
Yes, and I think that part of what history can teach us about this is that to really effectively understand, write about, prosecute, and actually deliver some social change around white power violence requires us to see it as a social movement, to connect events that might at first glance seem isolated, and to extend our imagination such that we can, of course without condoning it, but such that we can understand the coherence of these kinds of acts of violence in a particular worldview.
Well, Kathleen Belew, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Kathleen Belew, who's a professor of history at the University of Chicago, who researches the 20th century history of white power militancy through previously classified FBI documents, newspapers published from Nicaragua to New York, and vivid personal testimonies, letters, and illustrations. She's the author of the new book, Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
Lady dressed in white with a man she loved. Bye.